This podcast features three supposed adults who definitely use adult language. They're also supposedly writers who are definitely not procrastinating by making this podcast. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to No Bad Ideas, the storytelling game show where we take the worst ideas on the internet and try to turn them into stories that are actually good.
My name is Gabriel Urbina, and I am your first Bad Ideas host.
My name is Sarah Shackett. I'm your second Bad Ideas host.
And I'm Zach Valenti, your... Just kidding.
Don't do that.
This is Gabriel again. Zach, dear listener, sends his very, very, very sincere apologies, but he's still occupied elsewhere the way that he was a couple of weeks ago.
Yes.
But we have found another truly, truly exemplar set of people to take his place as our third hosts today.
And
our
fourth.
Special guest hosts. Yes.
Bonus.
We are joined here in the virtual studio by Chris and Jen Sugden, the creators and head writers of Victoriosity. How are you guys doing today?
Hello.
Hi.
Very good. Thank you. How are you doing?
Excellent.
We're doing great.
Now we get to talk to you. We're very excited to have you on the show.
We're excited.
Very excited to be here.
Yes.
Now we really want to get to these bad ideas because you are both fabulous writers and storytellers, and we can't wait to see what you're going to do with them. But before we do that, just in case any of our listeners have not yet found their way to Victoriosity.
And they are in for a treat.
Yes, they are. Do you want to just tell them the quick version of what the show's about?
Yes, that's very kind of you to say. Victoriosity is a detective comedy podcast set in an alternate Victorian past in 1887. And it is begins with a murder and ends up as a giant conspiracy of impossible proportions. And a sort of a detective and journalist must solve the crime, essentially.
Exciting, exciting. It is both one of the most thrilling and one of the funniest podcasts you will ever hear.
Thank you.
No small part because said detective is played by previous No Bad Ideas guest star, Mr. Tom Crowley.
Indeed.
He is.
Yes. It is one. Yeah.
Yeah, he is excellent. Tom is brilliant, as are the rest of the cast, who are insanely talented.
Yeah, yes, it's they are. I listened to Tom's episodes of No Bad Ideas very recently. Tom has the upsetting quality of being even funnier when he's just talking than when you
it's
write
it's very
things.
Distressing
right, right. Unscripted Tom is somehow even better, right?
Yeah. But sadly can't call that a drama, so we have to write things for him.
Not yet, anyway.
Not yet. Well, let's see what he does. Yeah, but yeah,
it is a rip-roaring good time, and we recommend that everyone check it out. But before you rush off to hit that subscribe button on your podcatchers, we have a little bit of work to do here.
We do.
This is No Bad Ideas, the show where we find some record of some terrible things that people have done and try to figure out how we might make them into the pitch for a good movie or a good book or a good comic book or a good, like, cave drawing somewhere really, really ancient. But it always begins with some really, really bad ideas that someone had. Are you guys ready to dive into our first bad idea?
We are.
Yes. We
sure are.
And I'm dead set on a pitch for a cave painting. I'm just putting that out right now.
All right. It's going to be interesting with this one. Let's see how that works. All right. So our first bad idea that you're only going to have 10 minutes to sort out. And dear listeners, if you would like to read along, there's going to be a link to this article in the episode description. Comes from our dear friends over at the Huffington Post. Are you guys ready to jump in?
Let's do it.
All right. The headline reads, British man changes name after getting drunk in lockdown.
Yes.
I was kind of hoping it was just British man changes name and the Huffington Post had sort of absorbed itself into the most banal thing it could possibly find.
It was a very slow news weekend. Right. Okay.
They've perfected it with their algorithmic headlines. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. British man changes name after
getting drunk during lockdown.
Okay.
But the question is, what did he change the name to? So the article reads, a British man formerly known as Thomas Dodd, has changed his name to Celine Dion. And it's all coming back to him now as to how it happened.
Good job, article writer. Good job.
Dodd told Birmingham Live that he had a few too many alcoholic beverages while watching a recording of a Dion concert and filed to change his name as a result. Quote, I am slightly obsessed with her, I'm not gonna lie, he said of the Quebec superstar singer. During lockdown, I've been watching a lot of live concerts on the TV. I can only think I've been watching one of hers and had a great idea after a few drinks. The 30-year-old hospitality worker lives in Tamworth, Staffordshire, and saw Celine Dion live in Birmingham back in 2019. Dodd says he received, by the way, I am not sure why this article is still referring to him as Dodd. It is very clear that he has a new
Dion,
name.
Yeah. Yes.
This is unacceptable.
Yeah. But Dodd says he received the official paperwork in the mail a few days after Christmas and
that's
apparently paid £89 for the change, as well as multiple copies of the letter proving it's real. This is what I love, that he apparently sprung for multiple copies of the proof.
Mm-hmm.
Dodd legally changed his name by deed poll and can use the new moniker on a passport, driving license, and other official documents. The new Celine Dion says he's not planning on changing it back right away. Quote, I'll figure it out, but I'm not rushing to change it back, that's for sure, he told Birmingham Live. I tried singing Celine in the shower this morning, and I can assure everyone I haven't inherited her voice or her bank balance. A representative for the real Celine Dion herself did not respond to Huffington Post's request for comment, but we can assume she'll accept the tribute because that's the way it is. All right.
Fantastic.
So man changes his name to Celine Dion. How might we spin this into a good story? 10 minutes on the clock starting now.
Just so many ideas.
Excuse me. How might we spin this into a good cave painting? I forgot.
Oh.
Parameters. Yes.
I mean, it's a tale as old as time. I'd be surprised if the caves of Lufkow didn't already depict such a thing.
Contain it. Yeah. I think we may get into some copycat business there. So we might need to pick a different medium.
You might be right. Okay. We'll flash
fair,
forward.
Fair.
Jen, how close is Tamworth to where you grew up?
Very close.
5 miles?
I did used to play hockey there.
Really?
Yeah, it's probably about a half an hour drive from my parents' house.
Yep.
Yeah, it's a bleak place.
but with Celine Dion in it now.
But this is the thing, and I'm just
considerably
thinking,
brightened up.
Yeah, I'm just thinking Thomas Dodd.
Yeah.
It's a, you know, in Tamworth, that is a very, you know, forgettable name and place, so
right.
Like I'm thinking, you know, this would probably be one of the most exciting things that has happened in some time.
I would think.
So
I'm torn between personally whether we zoom into the event itself of him going like a Hangover trilogy thing where, you know, somebody's on a bender and we just watch them go through the process of the bureaucracy involved in this. Mm. Although the sad truth is that things like this paperwork in the UK are quite digitized recently, so that's not going to be a very interesting sequence of events. There's not.
It can be a period piece. Yeah. Celine has been around for a while.
It's true. In the 90s.
But still as fantastic as ever. But you're right. Like, I think somebody, you know, going on a bender and then having to spend God knows how long, just literally going through the motions and commit and, you know, following through with this decision and what that actually involves, like in City Hall or whatever. But
right.
My preference would be, I think you have to have all of this done in the first 3 minutes. Right.
Right.
A Pixar style intro that basically does this. This is the prologue, right? This is what this man has done. He is now Celine Dion, and the rest of the film is the consequences of that action, which have to presumably lead up to him understudying Celine Dion in Vegas, right, to save the day, right?
He's driven out of Tamworth.
He's driven out. Yeah, he's driven out to begin with, for sure.
I'm thinking I'll just throw in this. What about a twist? that happens a bit later. He gets to Las Vegas, understudying Celine Dion, and we discover that this has all been planned by Celine Dion, who wants to fade into obscurity. So she selected him.
She Prince and Paupers him.
Yeah, and to replace
and now,
her.
And she's Thomas Dodd.
Dodd in Tamworth, Staffordshire. Okay. Great shopping outlet for her at a weekend.
I love this so much. Let's Christopher Nolan this, because let's take a sensible idea and just keep going.
Right.
What if she has already done that? Right. The Thomas Dodd, as we know him, already is Celine Dion. She's already Prince and Paupered herself.
Okay.
And no, I've gone too far. I've gone too far into the Nolanverse.
Only Christopher Nolan can do
no
this.
No way back. No, I don't. All right, reverse.
There are multiple Celine Dions.
No, it's nothing. It's nothing.
No, but I think I see what you might be getting at, where we think that, well, first, Jesus, the layers to this. Yeah.
Yes.
So first we think that it is just, oh, man went on a bender and did something silly while he was blackout out of his mind.
Just a surface reading.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Then we slowly, through a series of twists and turns, realize, oh, no, this is Celine Dion somehow kind of manipulating events to switch places with this man so that she can live his life of obscurity.
Yeah.
And we think like, okay, well, that's pretty twisted.
Yeah.
But then, and only then, do we realize that, oh no, one moment, the switch had already previously happened. Like this had already kind of occurred in whatever, I think at this point, Total Recall style memory modification technology had already kind of left them in their switch states.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Right. I think we've got.
I have no idea how that was exactly right. That was
no. It's exactly right in box office terms, right? Because what we've got to go, we've got to leave the art on the floor, okay? And we've got to think. You want people to be walking out of the theater with their mind blown, and when they're driving home thinking, wait a minute, that didn't make any sense at all. Why did any of that
happen? How you know you've succeeded.
You've got a box office smash on your hands.
This is a good moment for me to take another moment to tell listeners to listen to Victoriosity, produced and written by Chris Leave the Art on the Floor Sugden. having said all of that.
Don't scrutinize it too much in terms of plot points, people. Yeah.
Turns out Tom Crowley is all characters. That's what we reveal at the end of the show. That's the twist that makes the
Tom
entire
Crowley
story redundant.
Is Thomas Dodd and Celine Dion.
Exactly.
God, it would all hang together if Crowley was involved, wouldn't it? Yeah.
This is clearly an occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge. But this is what happens the moment before Tom Crowley dies. He hallucinates this. Celine Dion swap.
It does smack of hallucination quite a lot, this whole thing, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah, Sarah, what's your take on it?
So I think that if we're... I'm struggling to hold back the part of me that wants to sort of bring in... a supernatural element to kind of explain all this. Celine Dion obviously has made a deal with a witch at some point in her life. The notorious swamps of Canada.
Yeah.
Is that just Celine Dion? It's actually 35 flow. Different people.
Yeah. No, and she and this gentleman in England like actually switch bodies.
Right.
And I guess where I'm going with this is just ripping off this wonderful Japanese film called Your Name a lot, where they start getting flashes of each other, one in Vegas, the other in Tamworth, and are driven to meet and swap back. And maybe they swap again. I'm not sure how many swaps there should be.
Yeah. No, and I think that kind of like the fork in the road is whether one of them is engineering this or if it's something that's happening. Because I think that there is the version of this where inexplicably one day they both wake up in their respective corners of the world and find that they are slowly transforming into each other and slowly kind of, you know, getting more and more of each other's memories.
Yeah.
And this is kind of like, you know, seeing them somehow find each other and deal with this as they... you know, first furiously work to stop this and then kind of come to grimly accept this will just happen no matter what they do. I think that that absolutely could work. In fact, I think that I've seen a cave painting much like that. But yeah, I think that that's kind of like the crux of it, whether one of them is engineering it or whether it is forces from the great beyond.
Yeah.
And do is it a redemption? Is it like you end some like because it doesn't a switching story effectively end always? I'm going to say all switching stories end with people going back to their original selves and having learned and been happy that actually things are you don't want to be Celine Dion. It seems great, but there are consequences
of like for example having to sing the Titanic theme tune.
Yes.
Sure.
Yes.
Every night.
This is a good moment to say that obviously the title of this movie is It's All Coming Back to Me.
Yes.
Unless we want to sort of have them meet and try and if you know the circumstances are unclear and one of them isn't engineering this, they have to sort of explore and journey to sort of find the source of it. And then it could be I Drove All Night.
Mm. Yes. Yeah. Yes. I'm going to assume that's a song because of the way that you said that. But I sadly don't know enough about Celine Dion myself. But you're right. I mean, figuring out what on earth is doing this is also a great story.
It is.
Who would be doing it if not Celine Dion herself? Who else has that sort of power?
Yeah.
What?
33 seconds, now
yes.
27.
Okay. So it keeps changing. Dion. Yes.
I don't know. Goldman Sachs?
Yeah, there we go. Done.
Correct it.
Capitalism is a fault.
Very good, very good.
Who sponsor her show?
They're worried she's running out of steam. They need a guy from Tamworth. He's got Midlands energy. He's coming up. He's got the booze. He's ready to go.
Yeah.
And time.
Right, that Birmingham authenticity.
Yes, that's what Celine needs to really, you know, bring that spark to her show that's been missing for a little bit.
The Midlands energy.
That Midlands energy. She doesn't have it and she needs
it. Oh, well done, guys. That was tremendous. Very, very nicely done.
Good teamwork.
I hope Celine Dion's plural are both okay.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. I expect the original Celine Dion is quite smashing, actually.
Unaffected, probably, by any of this. But yeah.
Well, I have something that has nothing to do with Celine Dion, kind of unfortunately. And this article, dear listeners, if you want to read along, it comes from Rolling Stone and a link will be in the episode description. I saw this on Twitter and did not know that I would be bringing it to you, Chris and Jen. So I apologize on behalf of America for what I am about to read to you.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
But, quote, the dumbest guy in Congress asks U.S. Forest Service if it can change the moon's orbit.
That is a bad idea.
Right?
That's the kind of thing that kills everything on the planet, isn't it?
Well, this is an open question. Representative Louis Gohmert, who is from Texas.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Who admitted recently that some consider him the dumbest guy in Congress, appears intent on proving those people right. On Tuesday, the Republican congressman asked a representative of the U.S. Forest Service, tasked with managing America's national forests and grasslands, if the agency might consider branching out, so to speak. Quote, I understand from what's been testified to the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management that you want very much to work on the issue of climate change. I was informed by the past director of NASA that they've found the moon's orbit is changing slightly, and so is the Earth's orbit around the sun. We know there's been significant solar flare activity, and so is there anything the National Forest Service can do to change the course of the moon's orbit or the Earth's orbit around the sun? Gohmert inquired.
This is a really weak start to a James Bond movie, I have to say. Like, you know.
He furthered offered, obviously, that would have a profound effect on our climate. End of sentence. The article that goes on that the moon is currently drifting away from the Earth at the rate of roughly 3.8 centimeters per year,
a speed
that has fluctuated for the last 4.5 billion years or so. And though Gohmert didn't say it outright, it's also true that the speed of the, quote, lunar retreat, as scientists call the phenomenon, has at times coincided with the major changes in Earth's climate, like the melting of the glaciers. But it's changes to Earth's climate that cause fluctuations in the rate of the lunar retreat rather than the lunar retreat causing fluctuations in the Earth's climate, which is another way of saying if the Forest Service efforts at combating climate change were so wildly successful that they managed to stop the melting of the Earth's glaciers in its tracks, those effects could, theoretically, have an impact on the moon's orbit. But it was unclear what Gohmert hoped the Forest Service might be able to do at this juncture about the complicated gravitational dance the moon and the Earth have been locked in for several million millennia.
It's also like, among many other things, like, it's a good thing that that moon is American, so the Forestry Service has...
We put a flag on it, so it is ours.
Pretty sure it's the only country that's ever been.
Yeah.
Probably still American. Must be, right? Maybe we should check.
Still, Jennifer Eberlin, Associate Deputy Chief for the National Forest System, did her best to humor Gohmert's inquiry, very nearly keeping a straight face as she answered, quote, I would have to follow up with you on that one, Mr. Gohmert. The Texas Republican, for what it's worth, seemed open to waiting for an answer. Quote, yeah, well, if you figure out a way that you and the Forest Service can make that change, I'd like to know. So I would like to know, I'm going to put 10 minutes on this timer, what you would like to do with the moon's orbit. Timer starting now.
This has got to be a disaster movie, right?
It has to be.
It has to be. And you've got to start with kind of like, you know, a boardroom, people, you know, saying that, you know, climate change has reached a point where it's a critical point. And then
like
you
like eight to 10 scientists and politicians who are in charge of the world. In that room.
World government.
World government. And then cut to a sort of park ranger or worker for the Forestry Commission or whatever it is in the States. And just on his own with the trees doing tree management. He's left his work in the city behind. He's put that behind him.
Maybe got some personal problems.
Probably has some personal problems.
Yeah. Not so close
to
it.
Yeah, he probably had a relationship that didn't work out. Yep. And now he's just alone with the trees.
But a good guy fundamentally.
Generic looking, probably. Yeah. Sort of.
And the moon.
He's no Thomas Dodd. We know
he hasn't got the Midlands energy.
Who is a Thomas Dodd? Even him anymore. And what have the scientists worked out? That the moon is indeed fleeing from Earth?
It is fleeing. Just wants to get as far away as possible.
Centimeters
a year. But they add up to inches first, and then larger distances. I think we have to commit in this film, again, leave art on the floor. We have to commit to the idea that this politician is right. He's completely right. Oh, okay. He is 100%. Okay. He's the only one who can see
climate
through the
fog. Climate
change
is the fault of the moon.
Like, people don't want to say it. They want to say that it's gasoline.
It's our fault.
Or trucks or cargo ships or whatever. But it's not. It is the moon. And that's the only way we're going to fix it. And we're going to fix it with trees.
We have to plant trees on the moon so that it creates an oxygen-rich environment the moon stops.
So the crux of his plan is not altering the orbit of the moon. It isn't pushing it further away or bringing it closer. It is planting trees on it, which I guess would have an impact on the orbit of it.
I like it. Well, how do you get the trees there?
Do they grow?
To bring the moon closer, and then you have to push the moon further away.
No, but this is where the grizzled team of tree planters led by Bruce Willis.
It's only with his forestry knowledge that they are able to successfully plant a forest of trees that are able to grow without oxygen or soil.
Or
water.
Correct. Yeah.
Right. Because you have
but
to know
have
a lot
to
about
do it.
Trees.
They have to get up there and get them planted and get them rooted before the moon drifts too far away.
Ooh, and then you could have a problem because there actually is water on the moon. So the water could actually be detrimental to the trees.
They're oversaturating these dry environment, no oxygen plants, overwatering a cactus.
Those liberal eggheads messed up. They didn't have that in their calculations.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So he's got to go up there. and sort it out by hand. I meant Bruce Willis, but now you've said it. Louis Gomertz has to go himself. They're both going.
Who's playing him?
The politician?
Yeah.
I was going to say Alan Alda. He can make somebody detestable likable. He's very versatile.
He's done that before, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, but how does this relate to the... Is Bruce Willis the person we cut to at the beginning and we see in the forest?
Yeah.
He's with you know, problems and...
I think you have to pair up a down-on-his-luck forestry worker who can make these trees work in space,
space trees,
a politician that knows more about science than... any and collectively all scientists.
Yes.
Sure.
And
sure.
together they can do it. Mm. On a two-seater rocket.
It's the matchup we've been waiting for.
So, yeah.
So this sounds to me like Ryan Reynolds and Morgan Freeman. We just move them from those Bodyguard movies into this.
Yes.
No, is Morgan Freeman involved in those Bodyguard movies?
He's involved in the second one.
Oh my God, Morgan. Come.
Yeah,
anyway.
I'm not going to make Sam Jackson do this.
No.
But we've got to have, so we've got the, you know, they get up there initially, the scientists, the liberals, they put the trees there, they're confident, they mess it up because they haven't done their calculations properly.
Yeah, okay.
Then we have to get the politician and the lone tree person
up
there,
Space Tree Man,
there to sort it out. But they've got to have a dark moment, haven't they? What's there?
Do they have a personal relationship? Like the guy that's now a forestry worker just out on his own somewhere, like did he used to work with Louis Gomertz and they had a falling out and now Louis Gomertz knows this is the only forestry worker who can help them, so he has to go out and convince him to come out of retirement for one last forestry?
Or he tried to marry Louis Gomertz's son or daughter and the relationship didn't work out.
I think that that's probably part of it, and I'm even more interested in the version of it where it was a successful marriage, but at a certain point the politician promised this park ranger that there would be funds to preserve this national park. But then once he got into power, it was like, we got to think about the bigger picture. You know, we cut down one forest over here, we save things later on. And so now when he's coming back to this forestry man and kind of going like, I need you to help me save the world.
Yeah.
Forestry man, still in my head, played by a very grizzled Bruce Willis,
is
kind of going, I know what your help looks like.
Yeah. Screw you, buddy.
Yeah.
There's just a complete lack of trust, but the world is ending, so they need to work together.
They got to do it.
He has to overcome personal animosity for the sake of the world. And that is also the basis of all stories.
What
I don't quite get is the last act of how they actually solve this problem on the moon. I think it's important that we don't try and make it scientific sense.
I think
it's got to be what are you suggesting it was, Sarah? Is it the weight of the trees changes the orbit, or like literally the sheer bulk of wood turns the wood?
It changes the drift and the drag coefficient.
Yeah,
it's very scientific. The weight is distributed.
I think
on the moon affects its orbit for sure.
That's just the level that we need, I think.
I've got a good end, I think, which is that
it doesn't work.
It does work, and but what they discover is that now that they've by the trees they've made the moon habitable as a place, and and grizzled Bruce Willis is offered along with, you know, the leaders of the world, the six leaders in the room we had at the beginning, a spot on that new
Doctor Strange.
You can go. Our planet is gonna die soon. You can come and live in this
escape to the moon.
And he gives it up to look after his national park. He stays.
Goes down with the ship.
Does most of Earth resettle on the moon?
I imagine that at least a chunk of Earth would save some people.
He's going to stay here to try and save. This is a critical point. Yeah. He's going to try, and he could just have a last shot of him just planting a sapling.
And I think that this is a nuance that may be important, that whatever horrible cataclysm gets unleashed, it isn't. The entire world is guaranteed to be destroyed. It is just the Earth is about to become a lot less habitable. It's about to be much more difficult to live here. There's going to be more tornadoes, more tsunamis, more earthquakes, more firestorms, more sharknadoes. Who in their right mind would try to stay behind?
Right.
And this man sort of goes,
Grizzled Bruce Willis
I would.
Yeah, but I believe in the Earth.
But does that effect of moving so many people and so much industrial activity onto the moon not itself actually solve the problem of climate change on Earth?
I think that
about it too much, Chris.
The planting of the sapling at the end is surely some heavy-handed metaphor for life regenerating.
Oh, surely.
Yeah.
Yeah. 100%. Okay. Mm. That's true. Saplings do mean life.
You put a sunrise behind that.
Yes.
You know, people are assembling not they're not missing that symbolism.
Yeah. Excellent. Mm. Good.
Maybe he's doing this outside of some ancient cave paintings, so you sort of see the whole trajectory of the human experiment.
Amazing. Maybe in the cave painting, someone is planting a tree.
Oh yes. Now that is beautiful.
We don't have to leave the art on the floor at all.
No, exactly. You have to pick it up and put it in the film at the end as a heavy-handed visual metaphor. For something to do with a cycle about something.
Yeah.
We'll make millions.
Well, that is time.
Excellent. Nailed it.
I think we've cracked it.
What would this be called? I've been trying to think of a good tree pun for a while.
Oh.
Make like a tree and leave. I don't know.
Oh, no. Ooh, oh, yes. Well, that kind of works, doesn't it? Something about the moon.
I'm trying to think of tree names.
Moon. I was thinking when you said this was like a terrible Bond film.
Good night, moon? Question mark.
Mm-hmm. Oh, what if Bruce Willis's character is called Will, and it's called something like Weeping Will Lone or something, because he's on his own.
And that's a tree.
Uh-huh. It's a tree, because
Weeping Will Lone. Is that the best that we can do for a name that's also the name of a tree?
I feel like I've let us all down.
Are there not people's names that are sort of closer to tree? Maybe not.
I mean, Rowan is a tree and a name.
There you go.
All right. That's it. I'm getting my Wikipedia article of kinds of trees. We're going to crack this. You guys go a little bit on a break while we do this, but we'll meet you back here for the back half of the show, everyone.
Sarah here. I am breaking into the show for just a second to let you in on a little secret. There is a No Bad Ideas HQ. It's real. It exists. It's not just how we collectively refer to ourselves as a group. It's a place on the internet, and it lives on Patreon. Our Patreon page is the hub for all the things that Gabriel, Zach, and I do. It's where we post cool, exclusive mini episodes of No Bad Ideas. It's where the archive of all of the shows we've ever recorded live. And the money that we raise there helps us make awesome new things and continue making this show, of course, but also helps us create new series like Unseen. We have a Midsummer special coming out. It's very cool. You should check it out. But the place to support us for all the things that we do is our Patreon page. It is the HQ of No Bad Ideas. And you can head there by going to nobadideaspodcast.com/support. Again, that is nobadideaspodcast.com/support. Thanks for checking it out. And let's get back to this episode.
Alrighty, everybody, welcome back to No Bad Ideas. We are still here with our special guest stars this week, Jen and Chris Sugden, the masterminds behind Victoriosity. And we've covered some bad ideas in the front half of the show. Now we'd like to switch gears and talk about some good ideas, specifically this work that you do, and you do it so well. And we thought that we'd start with just... we'd love to hear a little bit about what is Victoriosity's origin story. How did the two of you come up with this idea? And why did you decide that it needed or wanted to be a podcast?
Well, okay. Let's see. It is quite an old idea of ours. I think it was
originally a podcast.
No, it predates podcasts at the degree of popularity that we know them now. I mean, it's exponential, isn't it? But it was about 2009, so like quite a while ago.
That's still early days.
That's it. That's pretty early days of podcasting.
Very early
isn't it?
Days.
No, it was originally written. The idea was it was just straight up write it as a book. It was something I was trying to do myself. I had the idea of Even Greater London as a concept.
Which, do you want to tell the folks at home a little bit about what Greater London is? Or Even Greater London?
Even Greater London is is the alternate Victorian world's version of London, right? It's the principal difference between that world and our own, which is that London has stretched and grown to encompass the entirety of the south of England, which is something that the idea came from a lot of different places. I think Jen and I were doing grad school at the time. Jen's work was in Victorian literature, and in particular, detective and sensation fiction. My work was in a branch of social sciences called science and technology studies. So a lot about sort of histories and contingencies of different technologies and sciences and how things can end up very differently to how we expect. And it's not a single trajectory that people might think. And these ideas combined with a lot of sci-fi on the shelf, a lot of H.G. Wells, and also the idea that I think is kind of part of the British culture. I'm not quite sure how to express what it is. It depends where in the country you are. We don't live in London. We live in Oxford. Mm-hmm. And I think it's fair to say there is a heavy cultural presence of London across British society, right?
Sure,
which is not uncommon in many countries. I think a country like the US is slightly different because you have 10 or more major cities of more than a million people, right? That's not so in the UK, right? There really is one. There are a number of very interesting cities. I'm from Leeds in the north, which is a great city, but London is by far the biggest. And it's, you know, in the US, I think you have New York is a capital of, I guess, finance and other industry. You've got LA LA for
Rats.
And New York is a world leader in pizza rats, not even just a national leader.
Sure. Uncontested.
LA is clearly your entertainment capital. And DC is your seat of government, right? And I'm sure there are more besides if you keep, you know, going down the list like that. All of those things are London in the UK, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it's a very common view that this leads to a gigantic presence of London in across British society as like overwhelmingly sort of important in good and terrible ways, right? Leading to imbalances between the regions, leading to people feeling neglected and left behind, and that's had led to a lot of political change in the UK for sure. So I think that idea in my mind, together with all the sci-fi and the science and the Victorian literature, just transformed into, well, let's do it literally, right? A London that, by virtue of the technological progress of this alternate history, has literally grown unbounded, right? As if London hasn't grown in the UK because of regulation and, to be fair, the reality of population growth in actual countries. But I imagined, take off any of those constraints, take off any economic and technological constraint, and you could imagine that it just simply would grow as far as it wished to, and that would effectively
cover
half the country, right? It might as well. It certainly wants to. So that was the initial idea, and there was the first sort of glimpses of plot were I had a detective character. I had the character's name is Archibald Fleet. That came very early, and the image that it started with was essentially rushing towards this tower that's in the center of the city that beams electricity outwards in this sort of Tesla magical sort of like dream fashion across the city and helps with its growth. He was rushing towards it effectively to prevent a catastrophe, right? And that is an event that actually occurs in season one. I won't say any more about it, but that's something he's certainly trying to stop. It didn't go very far. initially writing it, right? I think I certainly had a long way to go as a writer, and I put it in a drawer. What happened following that was Jen and I started doing a lot of live performances, comedy. Mm. We did a lot of improv in a group in Oxford that we perform a lot with. This led on to sketch comedy because we wanted to try writing some things out. Jen and I ended up writing a lot together. I mean, everybody in the group did, but Jen and I lived together and worked together, found that we could work together really well on things like that. And that writing turned into longer narrative theatre, all comedy. And we did more and more of that. We went up to the Edinburgh Fringe a couple of times, had a good time, had some good runs.
You brave souls.
Met some, I know, right? Met some Tom Crowleys along the way.
Met some Tom Crowleys.
You brave souls.
And after a couple of runs of that, we actually had a really good Edinburgh run, considering we're not already on TV. Which seems to be what's required to have a very good Edinburgh run
these days.
But we got away with it and had a pretty good run. And we came back and we basically wanted to do something else, so write some more comedy, and we wanted to make it so that every time people, you know, every time we performed it, it wasn't we have to somehow find our way across the country to wherever we're going to put it on.
And we don't have
book
to
tickets and, yeah, you know, do
flyer people on the street all day to right. convince them they want to come to our show right. and hope that they right. might be the kind
what
of people that
just
would
live.
Like, what if the show could it? Just live? It could just be out there. And then we remembered about the internet. And I think
fantastical thing, the internet.
There's a fantastical, magical, wonderful, terrible thing. And I think, you know, that it occurred to us, we're still not in the realm of let's do a podcast, but because we didn't know enough about it then, we thought more in the terms of what we, a lot of us grew up with, which is radio drama, right?
Yeah.
Particularly in the UK, an incredibly strong tradition of UK drama that has a shared experience across a lot of Brits. So obviously Hitchhiker's Guide goes without saying. And what was the production of The Lord of the Rings that we...
Brian Sibley's yeah. Lord of the Rings, which is so good.
It's just wonderful. Like, just wonderful, wonderful productions. I think we thought, let's do one of those. Let's do a radio drama on the internet, right? Which we quickly learned was a fiction podcast. There are audio dramas. We found examples of this. And what we thought, well, what can we do as this? And that's when we remembered about this old idea of Even Greater London. Let's develop this idea. Jen quite rightly tweaked it and suggested a second protagonist in the form of journalist Clara Entwistle. So it's a two protagonist show. And from there, we started writing it together.
It was good, yeah. And we started that very soon because we'd already been talking about it. We started writing it very soon after we got back from Fringe in 2015, I think. And it wasn't that long after, and it's where we met Tom, that I think Wooden Overcoats might have released their first season. So that was, again, I mean, that's such a fantastic show, obviously. That and also things like Wolf 359, it's like, oh, wow, people are doing this. It can be done. It can be done really well. Isn't this amazing?
Whereas, it can be done. Well, we're still working
no,
on that.
You're,
it can be
no,
done.
No, you are brilliant. Both, you're all three of you are brilliant. So, and that was like amazing kind of encouragement. And we found a lot of support from, you know, the audio drama community. And obviously Tom put us in touch with a lot of people, including Felix Trench of Wooden Overcoats, who was incredibly generous with his support and time. And he'd never ever met us, but he read scripts. He had a Zoom call with us to give us advice. I mean, it's just, he's just like an example of like the generous people that exist in this space.
He's a good one, that Felix.
Yeah. No, I mean, and so many other people as well. And that really gave us the kind of, you know, belief that yes, we can do this. And we assembled the team.
Well, and beginning, first of all, I think with Dominic Hargreaves, right, who is the producer on Victoriosity. He's responsible for the recording, the final product, and in particular, the enormous sound design responsibilities of the show,
yeah.
Right? You know, we've imagined a extremely sci-fi or sci-fantasy landscape that is deliberately and kind of explicitly difficult to describe and difficult. We explain it as being almost overpowering for people to witness that they're in this city that's gone beyond the realm of like human understanding. Things like you look out the window and it just gives you a headache. The city just stretches so far, right? So giving him the task of helping this make sense in audio form. Dominic had worked with us on a number of these live shows before. And was, you know, has a huge background in live theater, in, you know, production, lighting, sound design, and he was really interested in the challenge, I think, of a pure audio production, and went away and researched a lot of the sort of best practices on that. And then when we turned up in the studio, it was like, you know, he just ran the show. Like, you know, we need this kind of
mic. That's a dream.
Yeah, it was amazing.
That's a dream. You just write down complicated things and then another person makes them happen. That's the life.
Exactly.
We can say this because Zach Valenti isn't here right now.
Yes. Terrific. That's a great answer. That's in fact such a good answer that it knocked out about three or four of the following questions that
I had.
Kind of enveloped in it.
Great. Well done, Chris.
Which is great.
Gold star.
But here's something that I'm curious about, because a lot of folks who listen to No Bad Ideas are either working or prospective writers themselves. There's often a lot of people that write in with questions about working collaboratively, working together with a team. And you two are, as you just mentioned, a writing team. Every episode of Victoriosity, at least all the ones that I can find, have your two names as co-writers.
That's right.
You haven't listened to the secret Victoriosity episode.
If there is a secret episode, I need to know right now.
It's just one of us and it's wildly different.
It's the blue version.
Very blue.
Well, but I am curious about what is kind of that co-writing process like? Do you, you know, kind of pick scenes out of the episodes? Do you kind of like have one person write the first draft of it and the other person rewrite? Is it a little bit of everything? Is it a pot of chaos?
Well, it goes without saying it's a pot of chaos.
It's definitely a pot of chaos.
Good.
We are somehow still married.
Yes.
That's very good.
Yeah, that's well done us, I think. But it's how do we do it? So we plot together. We plot it. It is a comedy.
But it's also like a legitimate mystery.
Thriller.
Like
we plot it out as though it's a serious thriller.
And the two series we've done so far, they are effectively standalone stories. Right?
Yes.
The second one follows the first one in time and with some, in some factors, but they're standalone thrillers.
Yeah,
really.
They are. And so we plot it out as though it's not a comedy, work out all the beats. We have big windows.
And it can be quite grim at times too, yes.
There's some very dark moments. But we have these big windows and walls and we get sort of sticky magnetic notes and we use those to plot it out and get the structure really tight and the major beats down. And we'll then break it down into episodes and have like the major things that need to happen in episodes. Sometimes we'll think of characters and things together, but generally it tends to be, look, we need this number of scenes and by the end of the episode, we have to have figured out this.
I would add that at the same time as our post-its that are mapping out the plot, we have post-its on the other side of the room. If you see our house, it's just covered in post-its a lot of the time. Like if we're writing, it's covered in post-its. A different wall is covered in a candy drawer, I think people call it, like just a bag of ideas, right? We don't know where they're going yet. We don't know if we're going to use them all. We're probably not going to use them all, but we're going to throw them on the wall, right? Because we like them. We think they're fun, right?
Uh-huh.
So the interesting characters that we think it would be fun to have, interesting events or occurrences, twists or whatever that think it would be fun to have. And in particular with the setting, which is a fantastical setting, interesting locations. What in even greater London is a health spa in Cornwall, right? Like let's do that.
Yeah.
That would be an interesting new location. So we'll cover one wall with those things to then help populate the other wall, which is the plot of, you know, the actual beat by beat of what's happening.
Yeah, so beat by beats and and we'll then sort of layer on like character arcs, not just Fleet and Clara, but any sort of major players. And then we break it down episode by episode. We tend to, I'll take one, Chris will take two or something. We'll write them individually on our own. And then all the episodes will get written. And then we will give our episode to the other person who will then wildly change it or edit it down. Chris tends to edit more carefully as he writes, initially a first draft. I'm just to get it all down on the page. Like it's, you know, each scene is like, you know, about five times longer than it needs to be. And then I throw it at Chris just chops it all down. And then we just
You reap and then you sow, you know?
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah, Distill it to its pure
essence.
And I eat the pickles.
You eat the pickles.
I eat the pickles.
You eat the pickles. Whereas I have a lot less to do on yours, I think, because yours is so carefully planned. But so I win, I think.
In terms of effort.
Yeah.
That is what I'm hearing. That is exactly what I'm hearing.
But then when we're happy, it's gone back and forth probably like a couple of times. And when we're happy that we can't individually work it anymore, we will go through front to back. We'll go through together, line by line, scene by scene, what's missing, does this work, how can we change it, discuss things. And then eventually we'll take it to a table read with sometimes with, Layla and Tom, for example.
Layla Kachib, who plays Clara Entwistle.
Yeah, he's just fantastic. But also other people who were very much involved, like Nathan, the director, and other actors, like, for example, Ida, who plays Queen Victoria very well. But they're part of our comedy group and are comedy writers as well. And Tom is a comedy writer. And we have a couple of friends who are novelists. We'll get people who write as well as us. And we'll sit and have a table. Dominic will be there. It'll be a range of people with different skill sets. And then we will just say, like, okay, just tell us how bad it is. and you know, and then they'll give like really amazing feedback at a macro and a micro level, I think. And then from that, we will take all the notes, both of us go away again and think about like how much needs to change, where it needs to change, and dish out that work. Some of it we'll do independently if it's big changes, and some of it we'll just do together if it's any little tweaks.
I think it's a big process. I mean, I this kind of goes back from our days like writing live comedy. I know we learned later that a lot of people, when they have a show that they're developing, they'll start with half a show and see how that goes and then build on that to the whole show. We tend to do almost the exact opposite and write twice a show and then cut it down to the best bits, right?
Yeah, that's the way to do it.
I mean, I knew we were all friends for a reason.
Exactly. So it's extremely high effort version of the process. But go through, you know, in different layers, right? Different editing lenses, right? Like, is it hanging together as plot? Is it hanging together as character? And then down to the absolute micro level of, with a red pen, does this page have anything funny on it? Is it driving the plot forward? Is it funny? Is it doing something characterful? If it's not doing any of those things, chop it down.
And then the final edit, which I absolutely hate and find excruciating, which is, would this character use this word? Or, you know, like, would we want to say it in this, like, this way? Would we want that word at the beginning or the end of the sentence? Which is good because it's that right, like, sort of final polish, but it can be rather excruciating.
Well, it's not even the final polish. The final polish is when we get into the studio and Peter Ray, the narrator, points out that I've written something that is an American word.
Yes.
Right? Like, you know, you can't use that word. People in Victorian...
Headland and Bluffs
The Bluffs on the coast. I didn't even know. Or Nathan Pettigrassi saying this is bad grammar, and then us fighting about it and eventually realizing he's right.
Or he corrects our classical.
So you get two in one. You get performer and editor for the price of one.
It's really nice that you have these.
We're very fortunate to have this feedback that really goes right up until the wire.
and actually the actors sometimes are like, oh, I just feel like that character wouldn't say that. And they'll try something else and that'll work as well. It's really good.
I mean, that's true, right? We have the plot. We have the script as it wants to be, you know, as it is written. But if on the day it's not working, right, and an actor has a better idea, then we will record that too, right? And we'll try different things and splice it together. It's, you know, it's never really done until it's actually out on the feed, is it?
That's very true.
Now, another thing that I know that folks that listen to the show are always very interested in are questions of world building and kind of presentation of the world to an audience. And I can think of very few people in the world of audio fiction that have set themselves a greater challenge in that department than the two of you, because you have something that is very intensely period, but also very intensely steampunk and science fiction, while also being blended in such a way to be completely unique.
Oh, thank you.
And, you know, earlier in this conversation, we spent even about 5 minutes just even describing the world of Even Greater London. How do you think about world building as you kind of go through the story of Victoriosity? How do you think about how can you kind of present the information about the world to the audience in terms of audio?
There's multiple ways, I think. We do a big, big cheat, which is we have a narrator to describe some of it.
Nice.
Always good.
And I think we just about get away with it because Peter's got such a gorgeous voice to listen to.
Just that smooth, velvety voice makes it all go down but so nicely.
It is a big, big cheat. So that is a big way we get the world building, and that's certainly that I think was inspired by the book from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy that sort of pops in and explains bits of that world. There's also obviously sound design, which is entirely down to Dominic, who is incredible to give a sense of like the sounds of the world and this, and also through sound, the size of places and also characters' reactions, I think, to things. Is that right, Chris?
Yeah, I think the thing that we've tried very hard to do is to make it a very unusual world, but still recognizable in many, if not most ways, right? That kind of goes back to the original idea, which is that this is an advanced civilization. Not civilization. It is a technologically advanced version of London from A to Z, right? It is further ahead in real and totally impossible ways. And that what that has done is, and this again goes back to the interesting field of science technology studies, it leaves people in with very different reactions about what's happening and different narratives about what's happening, just as we have today, right? Is the internet a good thing? There's no easy answer to that. It's enormously complex, right?
No, but it's bad. Just bad. It's,
okay.
The easy answer, it's bad.
The show is premised on the internet being bad, so that's what we, that is what we
fair
have
enough
to say.
Okay, the car line. Then, the car, yeah, right? Yeah, like, yeah. You know, it's we can't say it's a good, or it has clearly, you know, benefits and problems.
Sure, sure.
And I think we approach the idea of like the people in this city have this ambivalent attitude to everything that's happening around them, right? Things have moved on in the last 20 years much faster that they can really get their heads around, right? And you have, you know, the trams float down the street on, it's hovering above copper tracks, right? You know, electricity is everywhere wherever you want it. There are automatons, they don't work wonderfully well. They're extremely uncanny valley and kind of upsetting to interact with. But then, you know, it totally depends on who's looking, right? So Archibald Fleet is a detective. He has been a detective for some time in Scotland Yard. He presumably has lived there his entire life and finds it all a bit draining and challenging, right? And a nuisance in a lot of ways. Whereas Clara Entwistle is extremely positive and dynamic and is new to the city. She's come from Yorkshire in the north, outside the boundaries of the city-state of Even Greater London. And to her, at least to begin with, this is a fantastical, sort of almost magical, like, city of incredible innovation and exciting things.
Yeah, we get to a little bit. Hear things through her eyes.
Yeah, we hear through her eyes, exactly. It's like a theme park to her, right? It's like this is every round, every corner, there's something incredible. It's through those different angles, right? Like the narrator tells us not how it is, but certainly how the narrator thinks it is. And the narrator himself is kind of a jaded, sort of tricksy character in the way he talks about things. Fleet is just trying to do his job. He is trying to solve the crime and just kind of be left alone by the city and the terrible sort of tumult of stuff that it puts upon people and like puts on their brain. And Clara is doing the same thing, but probably enjoying it a lot more.
Yes.
I think those are the ways we try and get it across. Yeah. As well as just like, I guess, thinking about like, yeah, we said before, like different locations, like what, you know, we want to kind of walk that line of it's recognizable, but also very distinct. So like we'll take a lot of things that are familiar and just put a twist on them. Like what is Buckingham Palace like in Even Greater London? Well, it's a terrifying fortress that, right? It's quite scary. Yeah. That, you know, that is not an impossible thing to happen, right? You know, imagine, it's 1887, but with the technology of many decades beyond that, right? I mean, to be fair, the monarchy in 1887 is pretty scary enough in its own right, to be fair. But I mean, you know, like we kind of raise it to the surface trying to make it physical. And primarily, we're writing a comedy, right? So we're looking for things that are absurd and exaggerated. And, yeah.
Terrific. That's an amazing and thorough answer for an amazingly detailed, funny show. If people want to learn more about Victoriosity, guys, where should they go? How do they do this?
Victoriosity can be found on victoriosity.com, which is victoriosity.com.
Got it in one.
I hope. better yet, type it into a Google and it'll fix the spelling for you. So you can go to victoriosity.com and listen to everything on the website, or of course in any podcast player of your choice, iTunes, Spotify, Pocket Casts, whatever you listen to, it is there. Start from the beginning, episode one.
Amazing. And if folks want to get more of you specifically, not just your creations, but your thoughts, your writing, is there places to do that?
We have Twitter feeds. We don't actually have a website at the moment. You can find us on Twitter. Jen is Jen Sugden. I am sadly Chris Sugden, but with none of the vowels.
Oh no, that is very sad.
I know, because there's another Chris Sugden out there and he doesn't even use it. He just doesn't. He posted one thing in 2016 and that was it. And it matters.
It's me.
The truth comes out.
Yes, I think find us on Twitter, and when we get around to setting up a website and actually listing other things that we've done, that would be the best way to find out, I think.
Yeah. And also, can I just finally say, loads of the people involved in our podcast also have their most amazing podcasts. People like Tom Crowley, who we've already mentioned, and Gemma Arrowsmith, Richard Soames, and if you enjoy the show, then lots of people are involved in lots of other things. Beth Eyre.
Yeah, if you listen to Victoriosity and enjoy it, please read through the cast and credits. Basically, everybody involved has a show of their own, or that they're heavily involved with, or run. Please keep following, and there'll be good stuff.
You are going to find some brilliant listening if you do so. Yeah. Jen, Chris, thank you guys so much for being on the show and for valiantly going up against our bad ideas. We really, really, really appreciate it. We've loved getting to talk and hang out with you.
Thank you. It's been amazing. Terrific.
Thank
it's
you so fun. Much for having us.
Such a treat.
This has been No Bad Ideas, produced by Gabrielle Urbina, Sarah Shackett, and Zach Valenti. Many thanks to our patrons for their partnership in making this show happen. And a special shout out to our Idealist members, Jennifer Schneider, Rena Sarame, and Rebecca Allen. Today's episode features music by State Shirt and Jazar from freemusicarchive.org. You can support the show at nobadideaspodcast.com/support. And if you love this show, please leave a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Thanks.